From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1969 in Kiev. Specifically, it was made at the Kiev Astronomical Observatory. Two scientists examined a photograph of a comet called Komsomola. A month earlier, while working in Kazakhstan, they had looked at the same image. There was something odd about that photograph near the edge of the frame, but they assumed it was just part of the Komsomola comet. But now they saw something else as they looked more closely. This strange object near the corner of the frame appeared to be an entirely different body, and further observation made it clear that it was indeed not just part of the Komsomola comet, and so this marked the first observation of the comet that is now named after those two researchers. The comet called, I think, 67P Churyumov Gerasimenko. And in the past few days, we've seen some jaw-dropping images of this comet. To me, it looks like a cartoon. You cannot even believe that we have the technology to do this. But if you haven't seen it, I'll throw a link up on our Twitter. That's just the start of our discussion about science this hour with a man who helps distill science for the masses so effectively. Brian Koberline is my guest for the hour, an astrophysicist and a professor of physics at RIT. And on BrianKoberline.com, he writes a blog about essentially distilling science news. Nice to see you in studio again.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
I was absolutely amazed at these images, and I thought you were going to come in here and say, yes, yes, you know, those in the non-scientific community get easily impressed. But you said you were impressed, too.
Oh, they're very impressive images. I mean, we are moving in towards this comet at a distance in which we really haven't. At slow speed, and so we're getting high-resolution images that we haven't had before of comets.
All right, so let's walk me through what exactly we're seeing, because we saw kind of a compilation of video, and we saw some still images. When you see it, it looks sort of like a gray moon-like chunk, but much more jagged. And where are the photographs coming from? Tell us what's taking them and how.
The photographs are coming from a spacecraft called Rosetta. And at the moment, it has basically matched trajectory with the comet, and it is then easing its way into an orbit around the comet. And so over the next 6 weeks, it will move into position to be orbiting, I think, about 30 kilometers above the surface.
So that's how it's getting close enough to take these rather remarkable images. What
right.
did you see when you saw this image? And once again, it's 67P Churyumov Gerasimenko. That comet, just do a Google search for comet pictures. You're going to see it.
You'll find it.
Really amazing stuff. What did you think when you saw that?
You know, it's one of those things where, even though we know some of the things about comets, when you really get close-up images to see how it isn't a dirty snowball, usually we're kind of taught that comets are dirty snowballs, and really what they are icy dust balls. And you can see this in the images. You know, it's much more rock-like. It isn't necessarily purely rocky, but it's much more rock-like. It doesn't look like a chunk of ice floating in space, which is how comets are usually portrayed.
Tell me again what took the picture. It's the
Rosetta probe.
The Rosetta probe. Okay. So you can launch a probe to take these kind of images. And are you not concerned that other space debris could hit the probe and destroy it? I mean, what are the odds of success of this?
Well, I think the odds of success are pretty high. You wouldn't normally get large chunks coming off of a comet. You can sometimes when you have fragmentation and stuff, but those are usually comets that go much closer to the sun. There is a little bit of risk, but part of that is taking that risk to find things out. One of the big things about this probe is that not only is it going to orbit this comet, but we're going to have a lander called Philae that's going to land on the comet. And they're both going to follow this comet as it moves in towards the sun in through the inner solar system. So we're going to see this thing as it starts outgassing and things start coming off of it and stuff like that. And we've never had that really close.
That landing is set for November?
November.
Is there, there's a pretty high confidence of success of that happening?
So far, yeah. I mean, there's always a bit of risk whenever you do these types of things. And this is the first time that we've landed on a comet. So it's a challenge.
Well, besides when Bruce Willis did it.
Well, yeah, when Bruce Willis did it.
But this is the first time we've actually really done. Okay, so what are the implications, though? What are we potentially learning? What are the questions you would want answered, and what do you think we're going to be able to study because of this?
One of the big things that we're going to be able to study with this is addressing the origins of the solar system. Most of the things that we see in the solar system are fairly close to the sun, or they've been they've combined with other things. And so we can get ideas about what the solar system was like in its earliest stages. But comets come from the most distant region of the solar system. And they're kind of the most pure in terms of what they're made up of. And so by understanding comets, we really understand of what the consistency of the solar system was in its earliest moments, in its biggest origins.
Explain a little bit more about, you say, where they come from. They come from some of the, kind of, I think of the far corners of the universe, not that the universe is a box with corners, but give me a little bit more on the origin.
Well, it's a little interesting. If you look at comets, there's two types of comets. We kind of categorize them into two groups, and one are called periodic, in which this one is, and the other one is called non-periodic. Non-periodic comets come from the outer edge of the solar system. They sweep in past the sun, and then they go way out again. If you look at where these comets come from, you find out that they come from all different directions. The planets in our solar system all kind of lie along a plane, and the comets are coming from all different directions. And this led to the idea of something called the Oort cloud. And basically, this Oort cloud is somewhere between 2,000 to 50,000 astronomical units, so 2,000 to 50,000 times greater than the distance from the Earth to the sun, which is about a third of a light year out. And it's kind of this halo around the sun where all these cometary fragments are. And every now and then, something will gravitationally perturb them, and they'll sweep in to the solar system. Well, since they formed way out on the outer edge, they haven't been anything boiled off. There hasn't been, you know, interactions at high speed or anything with large gravities. So the material there is about as pure as you're going to get to the earliest stages of the solar system.
How come we're taught to think of more of them as dirty snowballs as opposed to icy dust balls?
Well, because that's what we used to think they were. We saw the material coming off of them when they'd go through the solar system. And what we would see are what we call volatiles, but mm-hmm. we would see water vapor and carbon dioxide and methane and all these different things. And so the idea was that, well, that's what they must be made up of. And as they come close to the sun, they would boil off or, you know, sublime.
Is that outgassing or is that not the same?
Yeah, it's outgassing.
Okay.
I mean, it's the material would come off because of the heat. Basically, it would vaporize and then stream off. And that it was thought that that was largely what they were consisted of. And then as we've done other things, in 2005, we had a probe that rammed into a comet. It was called Deep Impact. And we find out that they're actually more rocky than icy. They're more dusty than ice. And so we've had to change our view of what comets actually were.
Now, before I move into other parts of our discussion, since we did mention the great Bruce Willis and really one of the great cinematic I would say that Armageddon was more of a documentary than a fiction, right? But but if you were running American policy in NASA, I know, number one, there'd be more funding for NASA. But number two, would there be more emphasis on at least looking at what is out there in the far and not so far reaches that may threaten us? Because this comet, by the way, does not threaten us.
This comet does not threaten us.
And most don't.
Most don't.
But would you be researching what to do if we felt threatened?
I think absolutely it's worth doing. One of the things we know from geology and through the history of the solar system, we know that impact events happen. And we know that impact events happen here. There are threats to modern society and civilization that come from space. They are not high threats. And it's one of those things where the risk on a yearly basis is pretty small. But the consequences of those events
yeah.
could be catastrophic. So should we start throwing money that way? Yeah, and we are in some level, but I think that is something that we would want to do.
My guest is Brian Koberlein, an astrophysicist and a professor of physics at RIT. BrianKoberlein.com for one of the really more helpful science blogs you'll ever see that kind of explains so much that's out there on a day-to-day basis. And even though he's not in charge of NASA, sometimes you think probably guys like him should be. If you want to join the conversation, we already have some interesting comments online at Evan Dawson on Twitter, or you can call 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's the number's toll-free, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. It's kind of I'm calling it the bonus roundtable, because I dragged Brian in after some of his colleagues from RIT were here last week. And so Brian's here. We can talk about a lot of different things. One of the things that I wanted to talk about as well was an article that Brian sent to me that you might have seen that came on the notion of science and democracy. and with the headline that says, "Science is not democratic." Before I weigh in with my take on it, why did you send that my way? What were your thoughts on
it? Oh, it was an article that when it hit the web kind of made a stir in the social media, both amongst scientists who communicate science and the general public. Because when you're a scientist, you're often accused of somewhat political bias.
Yeah.
And of, you know, this is one of those things that kind of makes us bristle when we try, well, at least many of us try to be, you know, somewhat apolitical. But there's always this accusation that people are doing things for political purposes, or the only reason you're saying this is true is because you want to get funding. And it's completely kind of antithetical to what science actually is. Science is based upon evidence and based upon determining from that evidence what the best models are that work. And it's not subject to a vote. It's not democratic. It's based on what the evidence actually says.
And so that article was probably one you sent to a lot of people saying, please read this the next time you get overly bent on the notion that this is just political.
It was actually sent to me. So so I'm part of that viral circle.
For the same reason, yes.
Yeah.
But for me, the article touched upon, and I'll read a section as well, again written by James Kanka in Forbes, I think, is where it came from.
I believe so.
The headline, "Science is not democratic." And he writes, quote, "Everyone remembers how the tobacco industry pretended scientific studies showed cigarettes didn't cause cancer. But when results finally came out from independent scientific studies showing they do cause cancer, the country, and even smokers, accepted it pretty quickly. As the president recently put it, I'm not a doctor either, but if a bunch of doctors tell me that tobacco can cause lung cancer, then I'll say, okay. The most glaring example of this distrust of scientific experts comes in climate change, evolution, and nuclear energy. Climate change, evolution, and nuclear energy." And so before the hour started, I was talking to Brian about this, and one of the things that drives me crazy as a journalist is that we see a lot of polls about climate change. And you could use those polls in two ways, but often news organizations will poll the public, do you accept that man is causing climate change? Do you accept that it's happening? And those kind of things. And, you know, it's sort of drives me nuts that it's invariably like, I don't know, 51% agree that it's even happening or something sort of pathetically low. And the news organizations could use that to say, science is near consensus that it's not only happening, but man is causing it. There's all kinds of data, evidence, et cetera, that support it. Here that is. Here is the evidence. And then, but only the only X amount of the public accepts that. Why is there a disconnect? Instead, a lot of news organizations will point to somebody and say, hey, this senator doesn't think it's happening, and you know, 48% agree with him. So, you know, a lot of people think a lot of silly things, Brian. And I think the media misuses those polls in a way that doesn't help the conversation productively. What do you think?
I think that's true to some extent. I think the other thing, too, is that media likes to project a kind of nice package. Everything needs to be nice and quantified and a very big thing. And a lot of science, you know, particularly cutting-edge science, isn't neatly packaged. You know, we have fierce debates over topics. And it's easy to confuse debates over details versus debates over the whole. So global warming, as an example, there is very clear debate about the various aspects of global warming. But the idea as a whole is not largely debated.
As in, it's happening.
As in, it's happening.
But there's a lot of things that we're still understanding about exactly why. I mean, we know that humans are contributing in some way, but we're studying a lot of those effects. There's debate about how quickly or what the track is, excuse me, going forward. But we get bogged down sometimes in the silliness of these conversations. And the article in Forbes says it's to our detriment when we don't trust science, that we get this bent that it's political. How often do you hear that, apart from just climate change, how often do you hear that science is just political?
I hear it less than I think other fields. What I hear more is, you know, that we're just wrong, or, you know, we shouldn't be saying that we know. We should say that, well, we think we know. The argument that it's just a theory. I mean, my area is...
Oh, God, that drives me crazy, too. The word theory is most misused anyway, but...
Well, I mean, and that kind of demonstrates an example where common language and scientific language can be radically different. If you say, well, I got this theory, in common language, that means it's an idea. And in scientific parlay, it doesn't. It means, you know, a robust model based upon a wealth of evidence, a confluence of evidence, if you will. And so you can kind of talk across people in some ways.
Do you know how diplomatic you're being, though, in saying that theory as a word has sort of a layman's parlance and there's the scientific, as opposed to the layman's parlance has butchered the layman's understanding of what it actually means in scientific context?
Well, I think you have to respect the language as it's actually used, as well as recognizing what it's meant. You know, when we use theory in everyday lives, you say, "Oh, I got this theory. You know, my theory is this." And people do that not for political reasons, but just because that's what the language is. You know,
but we should stop saying the word theory when we don't mean theory. We mean idea.
I don't know that you're going to succeed by regulating language.
I'm not thinking of regulation. I'm saying that, you know, we should probably be more open to the notion that we've been abusing a word and it has a bad bad outcome. And the outcome is most people think theory is an idea. But even when they hear it in the scientific context, that's why they hear theory of evolution, and they think it just means idea of evolution,
right?
Best guess of evolution.
Well, best guess is actually not far off.
All
I mean, it is one of those things.
Throwing a dart is not
it's
what
not
we mean
throwing
by
a dart.
It's not throwing a dart.
But there is a thing where we talk about in science that no scientific model is invulnerable to being taken down.
That's to the credit of science.
It is to the credit of science. And so some people will interpret that as, because any theory can be taken down, you shouldn't say absolutely sure. And the analogy I use is something like flying in a plane. Would you fly in a plane and feel reasonably safe? Yes. Would you let your children fly in a plane? Yes. Those are based upon scientific theories. And those are repeated by experiments. We have a confluence of evidence to do that. There gets to a point where certainty becomes practically certain, you know, and which is different from arguing about what philosophical truth is or something. A lot of science is based upon we are practically certain, for all intents and purposes, until we hear otherwise, it is true.
So we're debating the semantics of language, which is interesting, but I think it does matter. I have no problem saying, what does the evidence say? The evidence says X, Y, Z. But I do have a problem that, yes, it somehow undermines the notion that we can be confident in scientific study because a future study has the potential. There's always the door open, even if it's just a crack. A future study has the potential to change things. So one of the places that we've been having this discussion, and we had it on this program a week ago, is on the notion of dark matter. Can we talk a little bit about dark matter?
Sure, dark matter. Do you want me to give a review of
it is? Well, let's start with the definition, because it's so interesting to me on the way we talk about dark matter, because dark matter is something that's so poorly understood, or even poorly understood as being real. So what is the idea in general about dark matter?
Well, the basic idea of dark matter is that if you look at the motion of stuff we can see in the universe, so stars, planets, dust, things like that, they're all influenced by gravity. And if, for example, if you look at the motion of stars in our galaxy, the stars are moving too quickly to be accounted for by the mass that we see visibly. Now, that means one of two things. Either our understanding of gravity is wrong, and people who propose that idea would take a modified gravity theory. The other idea is that there must be something that has mass that we're not seeing, and that's dark matter. And the reason why it becomes a big deal is because if you count up how much matter you would actually need, the amount of dark matter is actually more than the visible matter in the universe. And it's not just dark because it's not emitting light. It's dark because it doesn't interact with light. So it is effectively invisible as far as light's concerned. And that's a little bit where the controversy comes in.
So one of your colleagues, David Merritt, has suggested, I don't think he's stated outright that he doesn't believe it's real, but he's saying that it sort of is a fill in the gap. And that's what I like about this term. There is a lot of debate about it. Is it a too convenient fill in the gap, or do you think it's quite logically constructed that we're still learning about dark matter, but there's reason to believe that dark matter is real?
there are reasons to believe that dark matter is real. You know, my colleague works on dwarf galaxies, and that's actually one area where dark matter really doesn't work. Dwarf galaxies is kind of, you know, the real thorn in the side of dark matter. But there are areas where it works. It works in terms of galaxy rotations that we see for our galaxy, for example. We also see things where galaxies collide. So one of the things we can do is we can look at clusters of galaxies. One of these is known as the Bullet Cluster. And you can see clusters of galaxies colliding. You can see where the regular matter is. But you can also see by gravitational lensing where the distribution of mass is. And the center of visible matter and the center of the total matter are different. And that's a prediction that dark matter makes, that when you would have colliding galaxies, you can have different centers of mass. Within the modified gravity versions, it doesn't predict that. Another area that you see is on large-scale clumping of galaxies. When you look at galaxy distributions across millions of light years, and we've got good surveys of this, what we find is that the scale at which galaxies cluster is consistent with dark matter, and it's not consistent with modified gravity.
When you talk about dwarf galaxies being the thorn in the side of dark matter, because dark matter just doesn't work in right. the way we understand dwarf galaxies, it's kind of like, let's say we were understanding gravity. Well, we're on the second floor of a building. And maybe long ago when we were looking at gravity, we'd say, well, how come we haven't fallen to the ground?
Right.
Right now, gravity just doesn't work, but because we're two stories up above the Earth. Well, it turns out we're sitting in chairs on a floor. That's why we're not falling. So is it just that dark matter doesn't work in dwarf galaxies, or do we not fully understand it to articulate it yet?
Well, the dominant theory of dark matter is something called cold dark matter. The idea that it's cold means that it's not moving around a lot, so it tends to clump. And cold dark matter makes certain predictions. It makes predictions about how galaxies should clump together, and that works. It makes predictions about how spiral galaxies, for example, the stars should move in them, and that works. It also makes predictions about dwarf galaxies, and that doesn't work. So something is wrong either with our understanding of cold dark matter, or it's a mixture of the two. We're just not sure.
But that's okay, right?
It's absolutely okay.
I mean, nobody's panicking that we don't know. It's remarkable we didn't know 100 years ago that we now know.
Exactly.
So we're on our way to hopefully understanding it better. This is Dan in Hilton. Dan, thanks for calling Connections. You're on with Brian Koberline.
Hi, Brian and Evan. This is Dan Courtney, by the way. I hope you're doing well.
Hey, Dan. How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Hey, I just wondered, I didn't find out really until adulthood that what made a scientific explanation truly scientific were the three basic components, that is, testable predictions, causal relationships, and falsifiability. And I just wondered if your guest would comment on especially the state of education in such a simple idea to help ferret out what's considered, you know, a real explanation versus, you know, a simple assertion, whether we're doing a good job of educating kids today as to, you know, what's really scientific explanation or not.
It's a great question, Dan. What do you think, Brian?
I think there are ways we could do better. The other thing I would add is it's one thing to be able to explain what those principles are. It's another one to get them kind of ingrained into your thinking. Scientific thinking is difficult, and in some ways it's counterintuitive. You know, it's designed to kind of prevent ourselves from tricking ourselves. And that's normally not how we run our lives. You know, when you're going out on a date, you don't say, okay, I'm going to set up a series of experiments and see whether this person is interested in me. You kind of do it much more intuitively. And much of our life is dealt like that.
Or if you take the Socratic method, right, would you say, Dan, I don't know, are you still there, Dan?
Yeah, I'm still here.
So, I mean, if you were going out on a date somebody, the Socratic method would say, I'm going to imagine all the ways that this person might not be interested in me, and I'm going to have to go about trying to validate those things. And if I can't do it, then maybe at least we can start accepting that premise that maybe they're interested in me. So Brian's point is it is a little less part of the rhythm of our daily lives, but we still have – Brian, we still have to teach it, right? We still have to make sure people understand it because it's so important.
Right, we do.
Yeah. But at the same time, I understand that, you know, the scientific method doesn't apply to every aspect of our lives, but we're talking about important issues like creation versus evolution. That's the first thing I go to is to show that evolution as a real scientific theory is, for example, falsifiable, whereas, you know, the assertion of that everything was created is not even falsifiable, so it's not a real scientific explanation. I think that has a lot of clout.
I think that's well said. Dan, thanks for the call. Brian, what do you think about that part of his point?
No, I think he's right. And, you know, part of the reason why we have controversies with some theories is not for scientific reasons. You know, we're all human. We like emotional attachment. We like political biases. You know, we all have our own way of looking at the world. And it's easier to accept ideas that go along with your ideas, your own preconceived biases, than it is to change your points of view. That's part of the reason why peer review is so harsh, because when you put forward a publication, you're basically advocating something that you think is accurate, and your colleagues are going to rip it apart harshly and destroy it if they can, because they want to get to the truth too.
To Dan's point, in a non-scientific, non-science community way, you know, maybe I should give credit to the teachers I had growing up, because I was never a great science student but always interested in it. But at least I've come through life, and one of the questions I ask people a lot on this program and elsewhere is, what would it take to change your mind? Essentially, that's a verbalization of the notion of, is your position falsifiable? You know, is there some evidence that could move you? Whether you believe the minimum wage should be $10 or $15, what would it take to change your mind? Whether you would want to vote for this candidate or not? Is there something that would change your mind? Whether you believe in this deity or not, is there something that would change your mind? And if the answer is no, there's nothing that would change your mind, then there's no reason to have a debate. Your position is not falsifiable. It's not really worth talking about in that sense. I mean, so maybe, and maybe I'm reaching here, but maybe Mrs. Maciag and all these great teachers I had growing up who probably gave up on me on the science student side, maybe they had an impact, Brian.
I think teachers have an impact far more than many people realize.
There's no question about that, says a professor of physics at RIT. There's no question about that. We have a couple of great questions via Twitter, and we're going to get to those next. If you want to join the program, it is toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI. My guest for the hour is Brian Koberline, an astrophysicist, a professor of physics at RIT. He writes briancoberline.com, which is a blog that helps explain science on a daily basis. And I mean, nobody does it shorter and simpler and yet not condescendingly than Brian. So it's fun to read on a daily basis. Glad to have him and you on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, what amenities does a city need to convince people to live downtown? Hart's Grocery Store opens on Friday. What impact will that have? We'll hear from city leaders, and we'll examine the latest trends in downtown living and available downtown space. What would it take to get you to move to a city? It's all coming up Tuesday on Connections.
On a November morning in 1979, computers at the underground command center of the Strategic Air Command sent an alarming message.
Suddenly, the screens were filled with images of a major Soviet attack on the United States.
It turned out to be a false alarm, but it wasn't the only one. On the next Fresh Air, Eric Schlosser discusses his book, Command and Control. Join us.
That's tonight at 7 o'clock on your public radio station, WXXI and WEOS.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections, talking to Brian Koberline of RIT, and an email from John. Hold on, I'm going to try to read my own handwriting and part of his email through the screen. Can Brian talk about the funding of research? A lot of people who deny climate change like to use the old saw that says funding is what scientists are after, and if they have groupthink about climate change, they will get more funding. Brian, can you talk about that process and why? Yes, we've talked a little bit about it on this program. I know that you've heard that before. What's the process?
The process for getting federal funding is actually fairly complex. You have to put through a proposal. It has to go through a review process. It depends upon the organization that's doing the funding. But it's very, very competitive. And, you know, there are different goals that different funding agencies have, but it is not a matter of groupthink as much as it is a matter of a practical expectation of results. there's a lot of accusation about how science is driven by groupthink, that, you know, if, for example, I denied the Big Bang, then I would not get funding. And one of the things that is overlooked with that is that a lot of scientists actually get very little funding. We talk about the big funding projects, and there are huge multi-billion dollar funding projects. But my work, for example, I focus on a kind of scrounging of data. So there are space telescopes, there's massive amounts of information that are gathered for various projects. And because they're open publicly, I can go and grab them and analyze them however I want. So something that's done from the Hubble telescope, for example, they have specific goals, and there are proposals put forward for telescope time. But I don't need that to analyze the data that's already there. So I'm not bound by a political or groupthink agenda. And that's true for a lot of scientists. You know, the other thing to keep in mind is when we talk about groupthink, we have so many ways of countering that, because there are so many places where you say, well, here was somebody who had a radical idea that nobody believed. They proved it, and then we gave them the Nobel Prize. And if it were groupthink, what we would do is keep patting ourselves on the back for staying with the same theory. But it's the revolutionary theories. The bar is high. No doubt that the bar is extremely high to actually change scientific views. But that's because the views that we hold are based upon a wealth of evidence. But if you can prove them wrong, we won't condemn you. We'll actually award you and laud you as one of the great scientists of the age.
And here's the logical extension of that. This came up in the context of climate change, but you could look at Big Bang Theory. You can look at all kinds of things. It's probably harder to make money and get funding, or however you want to describe it, if you're part of the 98%. If you're in that crowd, right? But if you're in the 2% who says, no, that they're all wrong, you have a huge money-making opportunity or a funding opportunity if you can prove it.
Exactly.
So, you know, if you're the person out there who is going against the crowd, the scientific community not only will embrace it, but they will make you a much better funded and better employed person if you can prove it. That's it.
If you can prove it.
That's it. So, you know, this isn't a case of, this shouldn't be all that difficult. You know, we've talked about numbers of scientists and climate change. We're not going to make the hour about climate change, don't worry. But but Big Bang, whatever it is, if 98%, if you hear, or 97% or 97.1 in a review of scientific journals are expressing a position that X is caused by Y or whatever it is, you know, don't just point to the other 3% and say, see, they're the clear-headed ones. Check their science. Vet them. Ask them why.
Right.
And if their answer is political in nature, you should probably question that, because that's not what science is about. And science should not be political. Let's get Keith, who's on the line. Keith, go ahead.
Evan, good show. Two questions. One is, when it comes to astrophysics, if you can prove something mathematically, does that mean it is true?
No.
Okay. You want to elaborate, Brian, before Keith gets to his next question?
No, it's one of those things. I did a post a while back where I say, beautiful theory, ugly data. And it was actually about dark matter, where you can make a prediction based upon a certain model. And if that model is wrong, if that makes wrong predictions, it's wrong. Period. The math can be gorgeous, but if it doesn't match reality, then we have to discard it.
Well, the reason why I bring this up, I have one more question, too, is I was watching, I think it was Nova or something, and somebody posed a question. Let's say you have a sun and you have planets orbiting it, and the sun disappeared. What would happen to the planets orbiting it? Would they still continue in their direction, or would they go off on a tangent, you know, straight out? And the guy said it was Einstein who proved that they would go straight out. They wouldn't continue orbiting. But, I mean, so he proved something mathematically, but we know that the sun just can't disappear. You just can't make it go poof and it's gone. So he was able to prove something with mathematics that we know physically can't happen.
Yes.
That was a premise of that question. The other comment is, how do people in the, and maybe it's more of a general science area, how do they deal with the absurd data that people believe that point to intelligent design and, you know, all the other nonsense that is based on belief and not fact. And then you wonder why this country on the whole has a big educational problem when you have people going around and they have a thing called the Creation Museum, and they throw you out if you laugh or mock the exhibit. But people believe it. How does the scientific community deal with stuff like that?
That's a hard one. Keith, thanks for the call. Brian's got to handle that with kid gloves, because we're not here to denigrate anyone's beliefs, and there are plenty of religious scientists, maybe not a majority, I don't know, but there are some. And, you know, you can believe in the tenets of science, but think that it's possible there are things we don't know about a creating entity. I don't know. My point is, Brian, I'm trying to help you with kid gloves on that point.
That's fine. Being in cosmology and astrophysics, I get asked the question, you know, what about God? What all these types of religious questions? And one of the things I'll point out is no one today argues about the existence or non-existence of deities or faith based upon dropping balls. No one looks at the motions of planets and says, ah, well, see, this proves or disproves the existence of God. But in the 16 and 1700s, that was argued. You know, you had different scientists who would look at the same equations, and one would say, well, this proves the divine order that is expressed in gravity. And then you have someone else that says, well, I can use the mathematical equations to describe gravity as far as God. I have no need of that hypothesis. And this was an actual debate. We don't debate about that now because the science has been aging for 400 years. We come to the same arguments with evolution. There are people who understand evolution and who are evolutionary biologists who are also religious. We have ones who are not religious. The science is agnostic on the philosophy or theology that people are concerned about. Science is about data, and science is about building models. It's people who make it a religious debate. And, you know, when it comes to things like the Creation Museum or intelligent design or any of those things, in terms of a scientific idea, you look at what the evidence shows. And evolution works as the best scientific model we have.
I think part of Keith's point is he thinks the success of the Creation Museum and creationism and those things is an indication that we are not doing a good job educationally in this country. That's a different conversation, I guess.
I think. I have a friend who's a psychologist who says, you know, we are smart creatures. The problem is we're still creatures.
Yeah, okay. Fair.
We still have our biases inherent in us, no matter how clever we are.
Yeah. Brian Koberline from RIT, my guest, and let me grab a question via Twitter. This comes from Nancy. Hi, Evan and Brian. Brian, have you heard of any updates regarding Bicep 2 during its peer review? Thanks from Nancy from Weekly Space Hangout.
Yeah. Hi, Nancy. Yes, there's been an update. Basically,
hold on. What's Bicep 2?
Okay, sorry.
Yes. Back,
had to
not
back
just
up.
For Nancy, but for the whole audience.
Yep,
go
yep,
ahead.
Yep. Bicep 2 was a project to look at polarization in something called the cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background is this afterglow of the earliest moments of the universe, kind of the afterglow of the Big
Bang.
Big
news.
Big news. They had a big press release, and this was somewhat controversial, but they announced that they had found evidence of an orientation of the light known as B-mode polarization. And the reason why that was a big deal is because one of the ways in which you can produce that effect is through early cosmic inflation, which is something we think is true, but we haven't had any direct evidence of. So they made this press release, and then immediately peer review started, and people started pushing back. Well, it turns out the results did get published. There's been some controversy over it. The results that were published are not as strong as the original claim. The original claim was that they had clearly found evidence of B-mode polarization. The result of the paper was scaled back to they have evidence of B-mode polarization, but they can't eliminate other possible sources.
Including?
Including the big thing would be dust from the galaxy that would scatter the light and create also B-mode polarization. So they weren't able to prove that they had eliminated all of those sources. But they were able to say that they had found B-mode polarization, and it looks like inflation.
This is what Brian writes on his blog about that very subject. This is what peer review gives us. The Bicep 2 team made bold initial claims. They were taken to task. Much of their initial claims have survived the process, but their bold claim has given way to a more cautious result. They got a paper out of the work, but they also had to eat a bit of crow, and that's never easy. But what we get in return is a better understanding of the universe. I love that. But that doesn't mean they eat a little bit of crow, maybe on the confidence level. That doesn't mean they were wrong. And in fact, we're getting a better idea of sort of the degree of rightness of their of the accuracy. And when you say the possibility that interstellar dust could be causing the B-mode polarization, do we have an idea of how likely it is that interstellar dust would be responsible?
Interstellar dust is always a problem with distant observations. And so they knew it was going to be a challenge here. There are ways to account for it. If you know what the distribution of dust is in the galaxy, for example, and that's our biggest problem. We are a planet going around a sun in a galaxy, so we don't have a clear, perfect view of the universe. You can map out what the dust is in the universe, and another project called Planck actually did. You can kind of subtract that out and see what the difference is. And they had not; they didn't have the Planck data, so they hadn't entirely subtracted out the polarization. That's why they get a maybe instead of a certain. The Planck data is going to come out. There's going to be some collaboration between the two. And then we'll find out. We'll find out whether inflation is actually real and observable or whether we go back to the drawing board again.
A week ago, your colleague Don Feiger was here talking about he had been part of a team that discovered the pistol star, known 17 years ago when it was first announced as perhaps the most massive star yet discovered, or most luminous yet, let's see.
I believe the most luminous.
Most luminous, and it's sort of still under debate about that. But he also indicated that you had to sort through a lot of dust, you know, and the reason we don't see the most luminous star yet discovered is because there's a lot of dust blocking it. Are we getting better at seeing deeply into space and seeing more clearly?
We're getting better tools. Yeah, we're getting better tools. We're also getting better analysis. One of the things that we're able to do now is to take lots and lots of data and filter through all of that in order to get the signal. That takes a lot of computing power. So it's massive amounts of precise observations combined with massive computing power to analyze this. And, yeah, we are definitely getting better at it.
I want to also point our listeners to a few of Brian's blog posts. Just for the fun of it, I kind of went through, was reading some of your work. And is it just about daily that you're posting, is it?
I try and post one a day, and then I've got backlogs in the afternoon of things I did ages ago.
I would not want to even consider what it takes to post daily on this, because that's a lot of work. And so here's one just from last week. And you talked about, well, the post is called Hype Drive. A lot of buzz about a new device that can provide thrust to an object without a corresponding counter thrust that, if true, could violate a fundamental tenet of physics known as conservation of momentum. So a lot of hype about this. You're trying to gear us back a little bit?
I tried to gear back a little bit, yeah. When this hit the press, there were articles all over about how this was going to get us to Mars in a week. It was going to take us to the stars, so on and so forth. And it's kind of an interesting way in which science gets reported versus how scientists see it. Because the way it was reported in the news was this could change the way space travel works. And as a scientist in physics, the big thing was, wait a minute, you're violating one of the most fundamental rules that has stood the test of time for 400 years. That's far more interesting at this point than going to the stars.
Right, right.
And based upon what they have, it's basically a device in which they put radio waves in a chamber, and they're claiming that it is producing this rule-violating thrust. So far, they haven't proven it. And part of it is because we say, you know, outrageous claims require outrageous evidence. And they haven't eliminated all the possible sources of error. And whenever you go up against a big time-tested theory, you're almost always wrong. Not always wrong, but almost always wrong. So you always have to be really careful to eliminate any other possible source. And they haven't done that yet.
Is this a case of the media not understanding how to report this and going into overdrive or hype drive, and the scientific community being calm and collected and saying probably not? Or is the scientific community also guilty of some of the hype?
Well, there's always a little bit of hype even within the scientific community, but a lot of it is driven by a lot of websites that go with, you know, kind of what we call clickbait linking, where here's a sensational title. Oh, well, it's not possibly as strong as what you think.
We see that every day. Even in the scientific community, it turns out. BrianCoberline.com to check out his blog. Lucia from Rochester is on. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Great show. Thank you. I'm a teacher at City School District. I'm always encouraging kids to think about science and careers. I know, however, that it's very difficult to get a tenure-track job at universities, and many places have adjuncts. But I know there's another layer of really intelligent people who survive basically by writing grants. And my question is, so now we have, I don't know how many, but probably quite a few researchers who do that, that layer of people. What happens to their research? How is their data shared? What are the long-term implications for having people who are not instructors but doing the research? What happens to the research? How is it shared? And is it only here in America that model is followed? What happens in, say, in Germany? Do they have the same model? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling, Lucia. Brian?
It varies a little bit based on country to country. One of the big things is that you're right. Not everyone becomes a professional scientist, and certainly not everyone becomes a tenure-track professor. But if you have an interest in science, if you are learning about scientific ideas, how to think scientifically, how to use mathematics, how to analyze and solve problems, those are all real-world skills that can be used across a wide range of jobs. Most people are not going to become a scientist. That doesn't devalue the need to understand science. Part of where we kind of focus is we look at the professors as kind of the only true scientists, and it's not entirely true. There are grant writers. There are people who do administrative work. There are people who communicate science, and they're all related to a scientific field.
Brian, your blog is a good place for daily science news. We've had some questions about where to get a good source of science news. And so nothing against the mainstream media sites that occasionally I've been part of it. Again, overhype results or maybe misunderstand how to interpret some data, et cetera. Where do you get your news from on a daily basis? And where would you advise someone who wants to be a little more in tune with what's going on in the scientific community to go on a daily basis for news?
I think one of the good places is actually on a social network called Google+. Which everybody thinks is a wasteland, but is less of a wasteland than you might think. They have a community called Science on Google+, that's actually a collaboration of scientists who work together to bring news ideas from their own topic. And, you know, fair warning, I'm part of that group, so my area is physics and astronomy for that. But we have biologists, and we have chemists and engineers and a wide range of topics. And the big focus is being accurate and not hype. So that's one good source. The other thing is, when you look across, there's so many actual practicing scientists or trained scientists who communicate science, and tracking them down and finding out which ones limit the amount of hype that's there or try to be reasoned in terms of how they communicate are all good sources.
Are you satisfied that scientists in general are born with just maybe their hype was surgically removed at birth, or are there some guilty a little bit of?
We're all guilty of a little hype. I mean, we all want to say that, you know, the stuff that we do is incredibly cool. You know, I mean, even if you look at my blog, I do a lot about astronomy and astrophysics because I think astronomy and astrophysics is cool. You're not going to find a lot about chemistry. I'm not as thrilled about chemistry. So we all kind of hype our own ideas.
Sure, but do you also, again, writing a blog item a day, do you find yourself occasionally wanting to check yourself to make sure that you feel qualified to at least evaluate and present and distill certain news?
Yeah, I tend to focus on areas in which it's close to my area of expertise. So that's why I focus on astronomy and astrophysics. But I also look at multiple sources and other colleagues who are also trained scientists to get their points of view. So a lot of times when things hit, particularly the ones that are really hypey, you know, some of the things are some of the things come out and you go, oh, they found this new thing. Well, I can write that pretty quickly. Yeah, we found this new thing. This is how it fits into the old scheme of thing. Something like the hype drive, you know, I looked at four or five different people and even recommended looking at someone else's writing on the same topic, because we all have different perspectives and different backgrounds. And so you kind of get a wider range of understanding by looking at different people's writing.
Great stuff as always. And thanks for being such a smooth scientific communicator for us, both on this show, also on BrianCoberline.com, where you, again, daily items, just amazing to us. He's a physicist and an astrophysicist and a professor of physics at RIT. And I'm sure we'll see you back here soon. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much.
One quick bookkeeping note. I got an email from a listener from the first hour, and Bonnie writes to say that when you had Zephyr Teachout, the Democratic candidate for governor who's challenging the governor, you indicated in a question regarding jobs that the Green Party candidate, Howie Hawkins, stated he believed everyone was entitled to a job. In fact, he indicated that first jobs would be available in the private sector, and if they were not possible, then there would be jobs available in the public sector. Having jobs in the public sector is not just a make-believe job, but there are real jobs and serving real needs. Your statement left listeners with the impression that the use of the word entitlement was belittling. Please correct. I didn't mean to belittle. Howie Hawkins did say he thinks everyone should be entitled to a job. He did say that he'd like to see the private sector do it first, but the government will help you get that job that you're entitled to if you can't find it in the private sector. So we've cleared that up. My thanks to Brian Koberline this hour, Zephyr Teachout last hour, Mike Glass, our engineer behind the glass, you for listening, and Barsook Records. I don't give them enough credit for providing the music of Ra Ra Riot, a band with some local roots as well. That's the music you hear as part of this program every day. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Member Supported Public Radio. We'll see you Tuesday.